From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition.
It's a big week in British politics, just concluded as the main Labour and Conservative parties finish their annual convention season. What have we learned about how Brexit is going to unfold over the next months and broadly about the future of British politics over the next couple of years? You are listening to Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I am Joseph Sternberg, in again for Mary Kissel, who is still off at her secure, undisclosed location. But I am joined today in our luxury podcasting studio here on the banks of the River Thames in London by a friend of our editorial page, a sage on British politics, Robert Colville, the director of the Centre for Policy Studies, one of the leading centre-right think tanks here in London, also the editor-in-chief of the CapEx website, which is a great go-to source for all things British politics and economy. Thanks, Robert, for taking the time to come in after what I imagine must have been a rather exhausting party convention season for you.
Yeah, no, glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad you were able to join us because I think that, especially speaking as an American, I think we've probably had more global interest in British politics over the past couple of years than we've seen in quite a long time. And part of it is related to Brexit. And part of it also is just because you have a lot of turmoil within both of the major parties, the Labour on the centre-left, the Conservatives on the centre-right. As both parties are trying to figure out what is their way forward, how do they respond to whatever signals voters have been trying to send, and a series of surprise general election results is a very surprising Brexit referendum. And my impression was that this conference season was actually pretty illuminating on that score, that you were starting to see the parties coalescing around some version of a vision that their leaders think might be workable for the general public, that might be able to keep voters on side. And I'm curious to get your perception of how that process is playing out. What do you think that we've learned from these two annual conventions just concluded?
So I think the key takeaway would be that both parties want to be in power. And that may sound obvious, but actually, it defies the recent conventional wisdom over here. Both have spent large portions of the last year or more, tearing themselves apart in different ways and over different issues. So, starting with Labour, we learnt that John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn, despite both being the hardest of the hard left, I mean, they are both, they do not believe in any of the ideas that have made. Enriched millions of people, have lifted people out of poverty, have created wealth, opportunity. They don't believe it. You can go back and read everything they've written over the last 30 years. It's crystal clear that they are. If you ask McDonald who his inspirations are, he says only half jokingly. Marx, Lenin, and Trotsky.
No, we should point out that John McDonnell is the shadow chancellor of the Exchequer, so he would be in position to be the
shadow,
next
shadow chancellor and ideologue in chief of the project, but. At their party conference, they were trying to sound like normal, reasonable people. They were talking about... I wrote about this for one of our newspapers here. They were actually adopting many of Margaret Thatcher's slogans about ownership and control and devolving power to the masses and empowering people. When they talk about, taking 10% of companies and giving it to the workers, it's the giving it to the workers bit that sounds really nice, not the taking 10%. And likewise, putting workers on boards. They're trying to sound like social democrats rather than hard socialist, and their party is kind of going along with it because, despite their fury over the fact that the Labour leadership isn't as pro-Brexit, isn't as anti-Brexit as they'd like it to be, despite the anti-Semitism stuff, they still can't bring. The mass of the party is now loyally Corbynised, and the MPs are just kind of still going along with it and can't quite bring themselves to make the break out of tribal loyalty or cowardice or whatever it is. And then turning to the Conservative Party, there's this sort of recurring phenomenon that you always get told that the Conservative Party conference is going to be the most rebellious in history, that it's going to be a seething mass of discontent. And then you get to the conference and, the Prime Minister stands on stage and everyone goes, oh, yeah, yeah. There's a sort of knee-jerk loyalty there. I mean, partly it's because, not that many. So, you know, it's hard. It's really hard to gauge how many activists are actually at the party conference. There's obviously a heavy kind of professional presence, lobbyists, other people involved in politics. But, you know, there were not. Obviously, there were lots of people who are upset about Brexit, but the ones who were wandering around with the Chuck Checkers badges, there were not as many of them as you thought there would be, if you see what I mean. I mean, the way people sort of showed their discontent was that, you know, the main hall was generally empty for the ministers' speeches, and the fringe meetings where we were talking about all sorts of ideas were absolutely packed. I mean, we ran 20 events under the Centre for Policy Studies and CAPEX banner, and I think there was only one where it wasn't standing room only. I mean, which is obviously because we're amazing, but it's also because, you know, it was noticed more widely than that was the case. But so people are looking for what comes next after Brexit. They're looking for the agenda, but they are not, and they are, you know, they are annoyed about Chequers. You will not find a single person, which is the Prime Minister's current Brexit plan, you won't find a single person who says this is an utterly fantastic deal for Britain. But you'll find quite a lot of people who are saying, well, yeah, but you know what, let's just get on with it. I mean, let's just get something. We are where we are. You know, there's a kind of, the calculation which I think is, and you know, I could be completely wrong because I spent quite a lot of the conference chairing panels and having meetings, and you know, I wasn't sort of walking around doing vox pops. But from the people I was speaking to, the mood seems to be that, as the Prime Minister reflected in her speech, the Conservative Party has recognised, and rightly in my view, overwhelmingly rightly, that Jeremy Corbyn is a far worse danger to the country, to Britain's future prosperity and security, than pretty much any form of Brexit.
Now, yeah, that actually gets into what I thought was one of the most interesting aspects of this entire 2-week process, because you know, certainly you know, readers who listeners who aren't familiar with this will you know, should know that typically what happens is that you have a few days' worth of party convention and all of the ministers and members of the shadow cabinet get up and give their speeches. But then the keynote of it is always at the end of the event, the party leader delivers a big set-piece speech. And so Theresa May spoke, as we're talking here on Thursday, she spoke yesterday, Wednesday afternoon. There were some moments of the speech that might have been a little cringe-inducing, particularly when she danced onto the stage in a self-deprecating joke about a gaffe that had made the news when she was on a visit to Africa a few weeks ago. But yeah, I thought that in general, what the people might have missed if they were focusing on that kind of optics was actually the substance of the speech and the fact that when they are talking about how they believe the Conservatives would make better leaders for the country than Corbyn's Labour, it isn't just about the problems with the specifics of Labour's agenda. They were starting to talk much more about this notion of what Britain should be about. What are the British values that a Conservative government would represent? Yeah, I thought that seems like a very interesting approach, and at least to my eye, a couple steps away, it seems like a bit of a change for the Conservatives to actually be engaging with Labour on a vision front instead of just the policy specifics or who can deliver a better kind of Brexit deal.
I think that's fair. I mean, it's notable, you know, that when Theresa May started as Prime Minister, she, you know, set herself in opposition to quite a lot of her party. She emphasised the things that made her different from the Conservative mainstream. The manifesto in the 2017 election, which went disastrously, was as much aimed at, you know, neoliberals as socialists. You know, it was full of lots of stuff about how government is good for you, and unlike your old school Thatcherites, we think that. And the emphasis this year was very much on after we should draw a veil over last year when literally everything that where could go wrong.
She had a bit of a coughing fit throughout. The sign behind her started falling apart.
And a prankster presented her with a P45 live on stage. But so this year, the focus was very much on what sort of unites the Conservatives rather than divides them, leaving open the prospect that Brexit will then proceed to divide them all over again. I mean, to an extent, I think that might be because, you know, there isn't. Partly because of the demands of Brexit, the domestic agenda has, in comparison to Labour, you know, the domestic agenda hasn't been fleshed out as much. the headline policies were about there was building more council houses, freezing fuel duty, which is something the government's done sort of year after year after year, which is very welcome for motorists, but it's not terribly exciting. Whereas Labour were standing up and dropping sort of crowd pleasing policies into everywhere. I mean the exception was an announcement on immigration restrictions after Brexit, which I think is very significant and probably hasn't been as covered as much as it should, but that's the kind of thing that you can squarely put in front of the voters.
We have been talking about the future direction of British politics. This is Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of the Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
The Future of Everything podcast from The Wall Street Journal. Another new episode is coming soon as we look at science, technology, and their influence on our lives. The Future of Everything podcast from The Wall Street Journal. The future is closer than you think.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I'm Joseph Sternberg in for Mary Kissel, and I'm joined in our studio here in London today by Robert Colville of the Center for Policy Studies, editor-in-chief of CapEx. And we have been talking about British politics after a rather grueling two-week party convention season. In the first half of our podcast today, we were talking a little bit about the big picture, but I think now it's worth digging into some of the policy specifics because, what you are seeing is not just a growing clarity about the philosophical distinctions that the leaders are setting up between the two parties, but also giving voters some real choices on policy outcomes. I think that you have a very far left approach that Corbyn is certainly pursuing with the Labour Party. A lot of talk about nationalisation, workers and corporate boards, worker ownership of various companies. You have Theresa May talking more about, on the one hand, talking more about being business friendly, but also making various promises about taxes and spending. I mean, what is your takeaway from all of this about how much of this is actually new? I mean, what if anything, do you think that we've learned about some of the policy specifics or the ideological direction that the parties want to go on some of these specifics that we might not have known already?
In terms of Labour, I don't think we learned much about their basic sort of principles. I mean, it's the fleshing out of an agenda that they've already had. In quite a sort of crowd-pleasing fashion, the one thing they just don't talk about, and they released a very well put together broadcast after their conference, sort of showing blighted, broken Britain and promising how they will repair and rebuild it. The one thing they never talk about is the cost. Their claims to have fully costed their policies are just nonsense. They don't talk about the impact, how they're going to do this. The fact that if you take 10% of companies, workers suffer, pension funds suffer, all the rest of it. It's very sort of utopian. In terms of the Conservatives, the end to austerity that the Prime Minister promised was interesting. Which suggests that there is still a £20 billion extra funding for the NHS, the National Health Service, to pay for, which they've promised. So that suggests that the dividing lines aren't as philosophically are maybe sharper, but there is not going to be unless things change significantly, there's not going to be a sort of massively tax-cutting, Thatcherite, Republican-style agenda offered to the voters. The Conservatives are going to be the party of no new taxes as opposed to lowering taxes, unless things change significantly.
It does seem to be really important in terms of how they're casting these debates, because I would certainly agree with you that we are not looking at Margaret Thatcher's Conservative Party here. But you are seeing a greater recognition, at least from the Conservatives, about the role of entrepreneurship and businesses, and trying to at least fit that into some bigger vision about governance. The phrase Theresa May used was decent, moderate, and patriotic. And you know, suggesting that there is actually something patriotic or part of Britishness about entrepreneurship and supporting the private sector in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would agree 100% with that. And there was a beautiful line where, so there was a, I can't say the word on a civilized podcast like this, but Boris Johnson had been reported as saying F business when it was put to him that business didn't really agree with his Brexit strategy. And Theresa May sort of stood there and said, there is a four-letter word ending in K of Anglo-Saxon origin that I would apply, which is back business. And everyone cheered. And it was a great line. Of course, then the next question is how you do that. I mean, the government is already commendably committed to cutting corporation tax to the lowest rate in of the advanced economies, or certainly of the major advanced economies. One of the things we're doing at our think tank is trying to develop policies which might put the flesh on the bones of that promise.
Okay, well, that mention of Boris brings us to the Brexit question, which I think is the other thing that is of most global interest in a lot of this. And I think that the real takeaway from this conference season is that neither party has managed to solve the fact that, or really deal with the fact that both parties are divided internally on Brexit. Now, it's most obvious, I think, in the case of the Conservatives, because they're the ones who are in government and are actually going to be responsible for delivering Brexit. So when you have a situation where Theresa May is out there pitching one plan, which is a version of this Chequers agreement that she reached with her cabinet over the summer. Boris Johnson, the former foreign secretary, is out there giving a fringe speech at the event where he's taking a very different view.
And I think not so much a fringe speech as a sort of a rally slash invasion. I mean, he swept into town, and before he packed out the largest hall in the building, which wasn't the main stage, and then swept out again. It was a very calculated sort of counter to the main event.
And he does tend to pop up whether you want him to or not. But the what we see is this division that the Conservative Party has to deal with, but the reality is that Labour is also very divided on this. I mean, what you could detect was a real struggle to figure out how to cope with the fact that they have a large urban constituency that was very opposed to Brexit, but they also have a large working class and very far left constituency that also might have been more supportive of Brexit for various reasons.
I'd separate those out. The number of people who oppose Brexit from the far left is tiny. It's basically who support Brexit from the far left, rather. It's basically John McDonnell, Jeremy Corbyn, and their kind of old school chums who were there with Tony Benn in the 1980s, and they view the EU as a capitalist conspiracy. But what there are is a much larger pool of Labour, traditional working class Labour voters, who hate immigration and who see their lives and lifestyles having been disrupted by competition, the decline of manufacturing industries, and then all these other people have come, that's that kind of grievance. And so you had this extraordinary spectacle where there's been a very sort of middle class metropolitan campaign for a people's vote, which is basically a second referendum, but they can't say second referendum because no one would like it, so they say people's vote. And they were pushing to get this on the Labour Party's agenda, and you put it through the party, because the Labour is a democratic party in the sense that the leadership is bound by what the floor decides. And what happened was this extraordinary late night operation by John McDonnell and those around him to cut them off at the knees, and so they ended up getting a promise of a vote only on deal or no deal, not on leave or remain. And so remain was not. And then John McDonnell went on the radio and went even further. And then Keir Starmer, the Labour Shadow Brexit Secretary, stood up in the main hall and went, no, that's not what he meant at all. We're still open to the idea of a vote on leave or remain. And then they said, no, we're not. And it's complete chaos. On the Tory side, similarly, the sort of latest version, no one thinks that Chequers will be the deal. The question is whether if there is a deal, it is a Chequers-based deal, and whether it's a Chequers-based deal which goes towards much greater integration with the EU, much greater, following all the EU rules and guidelines and limiting our ability to set our own regulations, sign our own free trade deals, etc., in the name of frictionless trade and keeping Northern Ireland keeping the settlement in Northern Ireland, or whether it's a settlement that diverges in the direction of a free trade deal where there's much less harmony between the two. And No one knows. No one has the faintest idea what's going to happen, and we will find out in the next 4 to 6 weeks.
I mean, it seems like the real problem here, and potentially something that has caught people by surprise if they were just looking at this from afar, is how difficult it has been for the British political system to absorb Brexit and come up with, you know, some path forward for it. And I've been wondering lately if part of the problem is that both of the major parties are actually internally divided, that this isn't really a fault line that falls naturally in that space between, you know, Labour and the Conservatives, so that you could have a governing party trying to do one thing and then an opposition party trying to keep them honest in the way that opposition parties do. I think that because both parties remain split in various ways on this issue, it's hard for anyone to keep anyone else accountable on it.
I think that's partly true, but I think, to a rough approximation, the Tories are now the party of Brexit and Labour are now the party of no Brexit. But the Tories are very, very divided on what that kind of Brexit looks like, as is the nation as a whole. But I think there's also we have certainly made some calamitous blunders in our negotiating strategy. But I think there's also another aspect of it, which is the European Union. You know, what has become apparent throughout this negotiation is that for the European Union, this is a matter of theology, not of practicality. They view the four freedoms which underpin the EU of movements, I think it's fairly movement services, capital, movement services, goods and capital, I think it is. They view them as so important that they are now say these cannot be breached for any reason, and any UK deal must either accept all or reject all. Of course, the UK points out, but you know, you let Switzerland divide the four freedoms. You offered America a frictionless deal on financial services, which is far better than what you're offering to the UK. We are your closest partner. We are the main security guarantor if Russia decides to kind of kick up a fuss. You know what? You know, can't we have some negotiation on this? But they are so reluctant to split this up and give Britain anything which looks like it might be a better deal than what it would have had internally. And certainly PAC President Macron in France appears to now be emerging as the main obstacle on that front. And if there's no movement from the EU, one of the things that has shored up the Prime Minister's position is that she's now able to say, after having been humiliated almost in Strasbourg, really kind of slapped in the face when she, you know, partly, again, due to negotiating faults on the part of the British, but also just, you know, the EU was much, much more nastier to Czechos than it had told us it would be. So, you know, the Prime Minister has a unifying negotiating position, which is, I've tried to negotiate with you, you've not treated us with the seriousness we deserve as a country. You know, guys, come on.
Yeah, and you know, from that perspective, I think that we are going to be coming up on a period now where we have to make some decisions on both sides of this front, because neither side can continue kicking this can down the road indefinitely. We have
they can. You can get to a fudge because there is a withdrawal agreement, and then there is the divorce settlement, and then there is the custody arrangement, effectively. And the divorce settlement is actually really quite close to being finalised, but that would involve us giving £39 billion to the EU and making all various concessions in exchange for sort of pretty much nothing. So it's possible that if, you know, just to keep the show on the road, you sign a pretty loose, you know, statement of future principles and then just continue kicking it down the road, which, you know, increases uncertainty for business and, you know, ultimately solves nothing. But this is politics, and sometimes that's what happens.
Well, and it's great for us in the podcasting business because it gives us something to talk about. But I think we are going to have to leave it there for today. I'd like to thank our guest, Robert Colville, for coming in. Again, Robert is the director of the Center for Policy Studies here in London, editor-in-chief at CapEx, and you can find him on Twitter at rcolville, R-C-O-L-V-I-L-E. Give him a follow. I am Joseph Sternberg, also on Twitter at Joseph Sternberg, all one word. You've been listening to Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal. Please give us a follow wherever you get your audio content, and we will look forward to chatting with you again next week.